Yo, what's up, everybody? It's another episode of Real Sun Car Hours. Today is Sunday, July 2nd, 2023. Yeah, we don't, there's no like happy 4th of July on this podcast.
Yeah.
We are your favorite Pan-African socialist political podcast where we talk about current events, local, state, national, international issues from a black left perspective. My name's Adam Hudson. I'm your one of the co-hosts here.
And this is Peter. I'm gone. Though I will say one of those fun history trivia facts is they thought the Declaration of Independence was going to be signed on July 2nd. And it's like, I think John Adams or something like wrote some poem. I was like, everyone will remember the day of July 2nd, but it took everyone an extra 2 days to get there to sign it. So that's why it was signed on July 4th. But anyway, yes, you know.
Yeah.
It's no, just, yeah. Unhappy birthday to this dog shit country.
So, yeah, this is Real Sun Car Hours. And to make it simple, go to realsuncarhours.org, our website. That's where you can follow us. If you like this episode, this is a free episode, but if you like this episode, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/realsuncarhours. $5 a month gets you access to bonus episodes where we, you know, read theory and kind of shoot the shit. You can also be a member at $3 a month where it doesn't get you access to bonus content, but you're still keeping the podcast afloat. And you can also just make like a one-time contribution. We are, you know, legally an LLC, but we're structured like a worker cooperative because, you know, this is a socialist podcast and we believe in workers owning the means of production. So for everybody who's like, how do I get in the LLC game? Well, maybe you should be a worker cooperative. How about that? I say that because even we're not a nonprofit, so if you donate money, it's not tax deductible, but we are LLC and we are a worker cooperative. I mean, it's just the two of us. So
yeah.
RealSunCarHours.org, that's our website that has everywhere you can follow us, and you can easily, there's a donate button and a subscribe button as well, and to subscribe, when you subscribe, you get access to bonus content. So anyway, that's some general housekeeping, but yeah, we have a bunch of stuff to talk about. Like,
Oh yeah, like, we got a lot on our plate.
Russia, France, the Supreme Court. Yeah, let's start with Russia.
Yeah, guys. You know, shit's, I just find it very funny that, all the, like, racial mad out watching liberals who are always so concerned about democracy and human rights in Russia were just so incredibly horned up at the prospect of Vladimir Putin getting cooed by, his well, you know what, they're private, it's a private military contractor. So what happened last weekend, brief summation of the events is that Prigozhin, I know I was gonna butcher it, I'm sorry.
I've been watching like a lot of the coverage, and yeah, we don't speak Russian on this podcast, but no. I know it's like, yeah, that's the printer is Prigozhin. And
Prigozhin, okay.
Yeah, he's the head of the Wagner group, and he used to be, you know, buddies with Putin, but
yeah.
The romance is over between Prigozhin and Putin. Prigozhin didn't have anything nice to say about Putin.
No. So, yeah, the Wagner group, which we've touched on, because they've been doing a lot of stuff in Africa, you know, and sometimes people are like, oh, well, Russia, the new great game is afoot. But like anything Russia is doing in Africa really pales in comparison to what the West and NATO and AFRICOM are doing. So, you know, they're not, I mean, yes, they're a private military / mercenary group. But they're like the biggest one. And they also like have some of the best fighters in Ukraine. And so that was sort of the, the head was just, you know, he was feeling himself, you know, after a while, because war does crazy things. And if you want, if you want like a good take, Radio War Nerd podcast is like the only podcast I trust for like intelligent takes on anything Russia related. But yeah, he took his army and he decided to start marching to Moscow. And then he got a call and then turned around and then went to Belarus. So it was like 48 hours, remnants of the 3-day, I'll call it a coup-bortion, the failed coup against Gorbachev in 1991, because it was like, you know, some heads like, you know, tried to do a coup and then everyone's like, what the fuck? And then they're like, no, we're not doing this. So, you know, I think probably some of the people for whom their entire meaning of life is hating Russia, were upset that not that many people died. But it's worth bringing up because like, yeah, it's like the, I don't know. It's not a good look. I mean, it is not a good look for Russia internally. And, And like it affects, you know, other geopolitics, unfortunately. Yeah, it ended with like the Wagner group. I still call it the Wagner group in my head, because I feel like when people say Wagner, they're trying to like invoke Wagner, which like, it's a little bit Hitler-y. but I don't know, because I don't know if that's how it's pronounced in Russian. But anyway, yeah, so it got brought under the head of the Russian military, which, you know, is probably for the better. Like, you know, I mean, Blackwater and DynCorp and Triple Canopy and all the other ones America has running around, like, probably would be, well, they, you know, America finds them better suited to carry out their dirty business, because nobody really cares if mercenaries die in America, but yeah. A lot of them do, but yeah. they're not soldiers, and they're not veterans.
Actually, to that point, I was watching on the Katie Halper show. She was talking to Mark Ames and Yasha Levine, and Mark Ames pointed out that when the death toll for soldiers are counted, they often leave out mercenaries. And then when you add in, because it's often hard to count, because some of those private military contractors are actually foreign nationals, so some of them are not U.S. citizens. And so that's part of the appeal of using private military contractors for the U.S. and for Russia and any other country, but especially for the U.S., is on top of the obvious profit motive, right? Like making money for these, you know, these big like private military corporations. It outsources the dirty work of war to the private market. So, and that's one of the, particularly during the Vietnam War, what turned so many Americans against it was seeing, you know, their own fellow American soldiers dying in a pointless war and seeing those images brought to their screens on TV. But when the soldiers are not, you know, like your next door neighbor, your next door neighbor's kid, when it's just some private mercenary who voluntarily signed up for a paycheck to go kill, those deaths seem a lot less personal. They often, you know, don't count, even in counts of military deaths. It's hard to count. Yeah. And when you do count them, it's like the actual death toll for U.S. forces goes up. Sometimes it could, you know, increase by a third to double because of how often they're used. But there's also the kind of plausible deniability. So like when the U.S. wants to conduct some dirty work overseas, it's a lot easier to contract it to mercenaries because, the U.S. can kind of deny that it had anything to do with, you know, whatever kind of shady business that the U.S. empire wants to do overseas. So Yeah, in that sense, the mercenaries, you know, when it comes to deaths, they don't count as real soldiers. And one thing that was brought up, because that kind of talk with Mark Haynes and Yasha Levine, actually, I thought was pretty good. And because, you know, those guys are definitely not the kind of cheerleaders for the empire, the U.S. empire. They're very critical, but they're also very critical of Putin. But they were kind of, you know, I think they kind of felt like the coup was sort of much ado about nothing. But they did say that the things that Prigozhin said, he was pointing out things that were true, which is that the Russian invasion of Ukraine was based on bullshit. It was based on lies.
He did have a couple bars, because he was like, you said, you know, the initial justification was to denazify Ukraine, and now there's more Nazis than ever crawling out of the woodwork. And he's not wrong. I mean, The war is fucking bullshit. It's bullshit from all parties involved. We also bring it up because a couple of weeks ago, there was the African peace delegation where the leaders of six African countries met with Zelensky and Putin. But on the way there, they flew to Poland, and Poland being Poland, decided to just like do some old school, like real 80s racist cop shit. What I'll say is that it's the kind of thing where if, you know, that kind of shit does not happen to G7 countries, okay? If they do, like, basically, they wouldn't let the president of South Africa's security detail get off the plane with their weapons. And they actually tried to confiscate their weapons. And then they're like, well, you can leave, because they said they didn't have permits for them, which is just like, of course, it's like, you know, not. And then, the Major General Rude was just R-H-O-O-D-E. I'm not sure how it's pronounced. I'm sorry. But he was like, yeah, I just wanted to show you how racist they are. And of course, Poland's like, we're not racist at all. Economic Freedom Fighters, that's what EFF stands for, sort of the leftist, like the left party in South Africa, was calling like for the Polish embassy to be downgraded because, I mean, yeah, no, it's stupid shit, and it's the kind of thing that like the US/NATO is doing this kind of weird turn on South Africa, you know, because they're part of the BRICS countries, which, you know, BRICS includes Russia, but they're always formally like non-aligned. They're part of the non-aligned movement. So they're trying to not take sides, but the US and NATO are basically, and they've sent like other messages, including like this bipartisan letter from Congress that, you know, them plus the blob are trying to start giving the message to South Africa that if you're not with us, we're going to start treating you like a third world country. And so I find it funny because it's like, yeah, just the same cop bullshit that, you know, is part of like domestic affairs also like rears its head in international relations. And, you know, also speaking of that, France is on fire, right?
Yeah.
Or maybe a little bit less so now, but has been.
Yeah, switch gears to France because, people are saying, oh, France is going through unrest.
Unrest, yeah.
So what happened, there's a 17-year-old North African Muslim boy who was shot and killed by police in France. Now, on first glance, it's like, wait, I thought that was just a U.S. thing that cops kill black and brown people. No, that's not the case. France also does it, too. So yeah, he was a 17-year-old boy driving a car in a Paris suburb, and there is a law changed in France in 2017, in which
by Macron,
Emmanuel Macron, where French police are allowed to shoot in certain instances. So that includes like when a driver occupant of a vehicle ignores an order to stop and are deemed to pose a risk to the officer's life or physical safety, which is, that's pretty fucking broad, but that also sounds like, oh, okay, that sounds like something, you know, U.S. would do.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, oh, cops, we feel for our lives, so we had to shoot them. So the French police initially claimed that, well, this teenager was being aggressive in the car, and we feared that he would run into us, but there was witness video captured that basically proved that to be a lie, that it wasn't true, and that they just shot this kid when he was in his car. And so that's why there's been lots of protests and rebellion in the streets.
I mean, Bloomberg had this great little infographic that was like number of cars set on fire each day. You know, France does pride itself on it, the ability to burn shit down when they're motivated to. And I will say that, like, you know, for the past few years, usually when French people start burning shit down, they also have some very, I don't want to say distasteful things to say about the non-white migrants of their former colonies. I guess it's good that France is willing to burn shit down over not white people. You know, it's, yeah, I mean, like, sure, I don't know. I won't say sure, it doesn't change anything in the sense of, like, it won't, none of this makes the police stop killing, overall. And it's also, like, you know, that's, like, you know, enabling abusers to be like, well, you know, if everyone was just nice, then they wouldn't keep doing this. Like, no, they're gonna keep doing it, like, but people are allowed to react because, like, it doesn't matter how big the repressive apparatus gets. Like, there's still a social contract. And when the state security forces kill people in the middle of the street, like, that violates the social contract. And when they, you know, demonstrate that, like, this is a repeated behavior and that, like, the, you know, people in charge of the state want it to happen, that's not isolated incidents, then it's like, yeah, I think, I don't know. I mean, I will just say, like, since France invented democracy or in human rights or whatever, you know, or at least they say that they did, maybe France should, like, step up and, you know, rethink the whole fucking superstructure and dismantle Westphalian sovereignty or something, because, like, this is, yeah, I don't know. I think that this is not, it's not a tenable state of affairs in any developed country, that this is just going to be a, this is just a fact of life. It really, I mean, it's not, it really shouldn't be, no, like, sane person, when they think about it for half a second, it's like, yeah, that totally should be allowed to exist. So, I mean, you know, it's in spontaneous events like this, like, yeah, they're not controlled, but I don't know. I feel like it is the correct response to these kinds of things, because, you know, yeah, like, fucking seven, like, these are kids, you know, and I mean, just the fact, you know, only for the fact that that someone got it on video, or it would have been, you know, swept under the rug like so many of them are.
So the victim, his name was Nahel. We're not sure. I haven't found his last name, but he's been referred to as Nahel. So a couple things. One, well, this is, well, one of my first responses to this is that, particularly when we talk about racism, white supremacy, anti-blackness, police terrorism, it's often framed as a U.S. thing. And I often hear from, particularly from non-black people from overseas, like in other countries, particularly in Europe, particularly in Western Europe, is that racism is not an issue in Europe. It's a U.S. thing, and that the U.S. is worse when it comes to racism and white supremacy, structural racism, police violence, etc., etc., and that in some magical way that Europe has somehow transcended race, and that it's above race, and it's not an issue, and that everybody is treated equally, and yada yada yada. And that's bullshit. And I think that this instance, the killing of Nahel, just I think makes it even more clear. And you know, France, their whole thing is like, oh, we're colorblind. Everybody here is, we're all French. It doesn't matter what color you are. We're all French. It's all about, you know, brotherhood, equality, yada, yada, yada. And it's like, okay, well, that brotherhood wasn't really extended to Nahel when the fucking French police decided to shoot him in his car. And when it comes to, like, racial and ethnic minorities in France, and particularly the black and brown term, and the term brownness is that's very broad, but in the U.S. When we say black and brown, usually brown it means non-white Latinos, like usually Latinos who probably have more indigenous ancestry in them. In France, most of the black people there are from French-speaking West African countries that were formerly colonized by France, and then black people from the French-speaking islands in the Caribbean, and then when it comes to brown people, we're talking about North African, usually Arab or Amazigh people from France's former French colonies in North Africa, like Tunisia, Algeria, Morocco. And I think it's important, especially when it comes to race, that North African Amazigh people, like, in terms racially, are not considered black, even if they're indigenous to North Africa, but because they're so close to the coastline, they tend to be like lighter
than, yeah, and you know, histories of whatever, right? No, it was a little bit ironic, I guess, in the sense that during the World Cup it was like, you know, Morocco was like, some people are like, Morocco's carrying it for Africa, and then other people are like, no, we're like not African. We're not like African, you know.
Right.
But they don't give a shit in France. You're all, you know what. But except not, because France is famously legally colorblind. Like, they don't carry any, they don't do any racial statistics or whatever. And that may be changing. But the thing is also, like, that's not because, well, it's two things. One is that, like, the inherent French narcissism that everyone in the world would just wants to be French, and there's no greater honor than being French. The idea that, like, no, you ruined our economy, so here, we just came here to work, but we don't, like, want to be, like, we have our own identity, and so that's, like, we're gonna hold on to that, thanks. You know, like, France gets, like, emotionally wounded about it. It's not just like, all right, whatever, just shut up and work. It's like, no, how could you do this to us? Because, like, that whole concept was created as, like, a triangulation from, I mean, starting from the Haitian Revolution, when, before sort of Haiti fully declared independence, you know, they were trying to figure out their quote-unquote Negro question. They're like, yeah, no, we're just going to make all of our colonies just part of France, and it's all one big French family that we just, you know, have to keep in line sometimes. But yeah, I mean, that's where it came from, like that strategy, that, or that policy. And yeah, so, yeah.
And what people have been pointing out is that police killings of black and North African Arab Amazigh people, it's pretty common. Like, it's not, this is, so the killing of Nahel, like in the U.S., is, it's not just a one-off thing. This is fairly common. And there's a Twitter thread from Yasmin Jibril, and I'm going to put it in the show notes because I actually think it's a good Twitter thread where she breaks it down. And so Nahel, his family, they were of Algerian descent, Algerian origin. And France fought a very bloody war in Algeria because Algerians were not having, you know, the French colonizing them. And yeah, there were like nearly a million people killed during Algeria's War of Independence. And so France has a very, very bloody history of colonization in North Africa and West Africa. And the police killings of the black and brown people who are their former colonial subjects, like, this is You know, this is not new for France. And again, it shows how much of a lie that French colorblindness is, because all it does is just mask France's own history of colonization, white supremacy, and ongoing and historical racism. And actually, before Nahel was killed, there was a black boy killed by French cops as well. So, you know, like in the U.S., this is not uncommon. And I think especially when terms like white supremacy are used, it has to be understood as a global system. It's not just a U.S. system. The eyes get focused on the U.S. because, I think largely because of, one, the Black American struggle here and the militancy here putting light to it. And also, I think, because of the U.S., its model of white supremacy is more similar to South African-style apartheid, in that, like, you had, like, kind of more open, a history of open, legalized racial discrimination that, you know, arguably in Western Europe, it didn't have that kind of, like, open, legalized racial apartheid. But there's still institutional racism in Western Europe, even if it doesn't look like U.S. style or South Africa style of a history of apartheid. So I think that's why attention gets focused on the U.S., because the U.S. has a long history of open, legalized racial discrimination, and also the history with the fucking Civil War and the Confederacy. So those are important distinctions, but I think what this instance shows is that white supremacy and systemic racism is global. It's a global system. It manifests itself in different ways in different countries based on the unique history of those countries. Like, there's systemic racism in Latin America against black people, but the way that racism was structured in Latin America during slavery was a little bit different than in the U.S. So that also means, like, how people talk about race in Latin America might be slightly different, but the effect is the same, which is that black people of African descent are treated like shit. And, you know, in the case of France, it's black people and people of North African origin who are at the receiving end of the violence of the French police and the French state apparatus. And that violence is tied to France's own history of colonialism, slavery, white supremacy. And it doesn't matter, like, how much, like, the French try to say, like, oh, we're all about equality, egalitarianism. Like, bull fucking shit. Bull fucking shit. France is full of shit when they preach that. In the same way that the United States is full of shit when it says, oh, we're a beacon of freedom and democracy, but was founded on fucking slavery. It still has white supremacy and anti-blackness. France is just as equally as full of shit when it says, we care about human rights and equality. Bull fucking shit. So I think, like, that's the main point that has to be hammered home. That's what I want to hammer home, is that this idea that Europe and Western Europe is so much more enlightened when it comes to human rights and it's above race. Bull fucking shit. It's all fucking bullshit. And anyone who says that, I'm sorry, they're just fucking lying to you. They're full of shit. And it's usually people who are not black living in Europe who say that. The ones who are not, like, total coons, but the black people in Europe will tell you, like, hey, wait a second, there's racism here too, even if the history is slightly different in terms of how race manifests itself. There's still racism. I guess my final point would be, one thing that's been heartening is that I've been noticing that people have been making connections between this and the protests after the killing of George Floyd in the U.S. in 2020. And one thing I noticed, which is a good thing, is that I think the protests after the killing of George Floyd in the U.S., they spread globally. And there was this kind of brief moment of solidarity, global solidarity with Black America. But the other side I noticed is that Black people in other parts of the world, in other parts of the African diaspora, have used that to shed light on the violence and white supremacy that they face in the countries that they live in, and showing that anti-Black violence, white supremacist violence, is an issue in other parts of the world where Black people reside. So I think these protests in France are a good thing. I'm glad to see it, and I want to see more connections made between white supremacy in various parts of the world, not just the U.S., because again, this is a global system, and it requires at least some sense of global international framework and solidarity to fight against it. And I think there's a lot that, like, you know, we can learn from each other on that front.
Yeah.
I'm gonna say, Peter, because I have a way to connect this to the U.S.
Okay. But... yeah. I just want to say, I mean, first of all, the longer I stay in the restaurant industry, the clearer and purer my hatred of France becomes. If only because, God damn it, you guys did not invent cooking. I swear to God. But also. I'm all about denying French agency in the sense that, like, all these Western European governments are NATO puppets at this point. And so, like, I mean, it's not really that much of a reach to say that, like, yeah, part of what NATO does is export, you know. The model is honed, perfected in the long U.S. counterinsurgency in the 80s and 90s, and that's probably the best way to... talk about, like, the war on drugs and everything. They export it. Everyone's becoming Americanized, so it is a global organic system in and of itself, but white supremacy. But at the same time, it is also, like, from a materialist perspective, actually, like, exported and, you know, trained and honed through security cooperation exercises and whatever. I mean, you know, in the members only part of the G7 conference or whatever, you know, they talk about this shit. It's all part of the same team. So that is why, like, resistance to this stuff has to be international. Like, yeah. It just has to be. Because you can't, yeah, and it, you know, and that's also including, like, the fucking far right in all these countries all, like, hang out, you know, are on conference calls with each other, and they all, like, stoke the same fears to, you know, avoid the problem, because it's like, you know, they are like, you know, some, like, because it's seen as their recent arrivals, and so therefore, like, oh, why do we have to keep getting all these boats of migrants from our former colonies just because we destroy their economy? And to be very clear, like, France's great social democracy relies very heavily on extracted wealth from Africa. It would not be much better than one of the many countries they exploit if not for just straight up extracted wealth. You know, accepting the workers from the economies they destroyed is literally the least they could do. But the weird, like, I don't know if this is what the post left is, but I think they're really just actually fascist. They're just too afraid to admit it. I think that most post left people give me that vibe. You know, they're like, oh, why are there so many migrants? Like, this is some globalist American conspiracy to, like, make us look like them. And it's like, I don't know. Even if that's true, like, that's the reality of the system. Like, yeah, you guys are NATO's bitch. Every single Western European country is that. So, you know, all these things are related. But the problem is that, like, the reason the far right gets, like, stoked and tolerated by these same security agencies, even though the far right poses more of a security threat than, like, working class, you know, minorities, is that it's very effective at dividing the working class. And so instead of, because, you know, I don't know, honestly, even the French Communist Party has had a bit of yikes moments throughout its history. But either way, like, you fight the systems through organized working class solidarity across racial lines, because, like, the point of these systems is to keep the working class of these identities in their place. That's the point. And, you know, that, like, white people will get taken down along as collateral damage doesn't matter to them. So you have to attack the heart of the problem. You know, you have to get at it at the root, and not do whatever the fucking dumbass yellow vest thing was that they did for 3 years that didn't fucking go anywhere. So, because Macron is, like, taking your pensions, he's taking a 35-hour work week, and you're going to be working like fucking Americans, France. So, you know.
Yeah.
You want to waste time dicking around with arguing about migrants, like, or do you want to organize with them? So, yes, in that sense, it is heartening to see France maybe slightly pull its head out of its ass. But it's France, so I don't think they'll ever do that.
Yeah, and I'll briefly mention this to kind of connect it to the U.S. There's this article in Mission Local, which is a local San Francisco, covers local San Francisco news and politics. And this is published a couple of months ago in March. And the title is, "Yes, the SFPD has a staffing crisis, but that's just the beginning." And so it talks about, like, how the number of fully sworn officers has declined, although civilian staff is increased in SFPD, but the number of fully sworn officers has decreased. And a main part of reasons for the understaffing in SFPD, a huge part is that many are leaving due to retirement. So there's a lot of officers who got hired a couple decades ago, and, you know, they're close to retirement. Then there's internal distrust between, like, people at the top and people at the bottom in terms of the police department. And then there is some bullshit that they said, which was, the reason why there's understaffing is, quote, one-sided and biased reporting. This is actually, I think, that part about the one-sided biased reporting comes from another article in Mission Local, which was published last month. One officer said, in addition to internal issues and tensions between command staff and line officers, this police officer said, external factors contribute to low morale, which included, quote, one-sided biased reporting by the media and, quote, unfair prosecutions, unquote, of officers and, quote, vitriolic sociopolitical, unquote, perceptions of policing. So basically, because there's more awareness of the bullshit that cops do.
The fucking media says, like, that we kill people when we kill people. We've never been so oppressed.
Yeah, and it's just like, they're just fucking, like, whining like little babies. Like, oh, there's low morale because you guys are showing that we actually kill people. We kill unarmed people, and there's all this unfair prosecution of police who killed unarmed people. And so now the police in San Francisco, according to the March article, that they're approaching their job like firefighters. So they're staying in their stations of vehicles and waiting for calls, versus what a previous officer, retired cop said. Okay, this is what a retired cop quoted said. He said, 40 years ago, when I became a cop, the job had a better rep. Cops had more autonomy and less accountability. That's not a good thing, but there is an attraction there. When I was a rookie cop, we knew we can get away with whatever we wanted, and we did. Okay, so, there's more autonomy and less accountability, so that's what attracted people to the profession of being a police officer. Now, like, okay, it's a little more scrutiny, and so now cops want to complain, and they're like, okay, well, we're just gonna sit in our stations in our vehicles and like, you know, just it's basically like it's like quiet quitting. And so I think like when people say, oh, the reason why fucking there's crime in San Francisco is because of defund the police and Black Lives Matter, it's like, no, like maybe the cops should just, I don't know, change their fucking behavior. Like,
yeah,
I don't know, like reform from the inside. Like, if, you know, if we're not going to abolish or defund police. And by the way, there's been no defunding the police. So, like, police budgets have not decreased. But I wanted to mention this article because it's what I think it shows is that I think, like, the police are just intentionally not doing their jobs. So that they can like make an excuse, like, see, this is why there's crime in San. It's basically that. And I think when Chesa Boudin, who was a former district attorney of San Francisco, who was the more progressive one, and then he got recalled and replaced by Brooke Jenkins, the cops didn't like him either. And so I think that and this is based on like what other kind of people on the ground and some journalists have pointed out that. They didn't like him, and so they intentionally just decided not to cooperate with him. And so that made his job as a DA a lot harder to do his job as a DA, but also, you know, reform, you know, make reforms from the inside. I mean, whether – I'm not going to even question the efficacy on that. But basically what I'm saying is that you can't blame the crime in San Francisco on defunding the police and Black Lives Matter. These are just police quiet quitting, and rather than owning up to the dirt within their own department and making some changes, they're just like, oh, we're just gonna not do our jobs, and you know, this is, you guys are being mean to us. And it's just like, no, I can't imagine any other profession where that kind of behavior would just be allowed.
Except, we may have a bit of disagreement because I don't want the cops to quote unquote do their jobs. I don't know when they never actually stopped crime. Was cop show propaganda. Literally, it's hilarious that he said that because, right, Dirty Harry takes place in San Francisco. Yep. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah. Imagining all the fucking goons that watch Dirty Harry and like join the SFPD because they wanted to do that. And it is the great American story of decline from unbridled psychopathy to just whininess that you are now expected to behave like everyone else.
Right. Yeah. And you know? That's the reason why I'm bringing this up. It's not like, it's more than just like, whether or not cops should do their job. It's just what pissed me off is that the sense of arrogance and entitlement that I read when I saw this is that, wow, like, you know, even if one doesn't agree with a police abolition or defunding the police, the fact that they don't even want to make modest reforms that people were talking about, rather than doing that, it's like, oh, we're just, you know, gonna quiet quit. And like the real source of crime in San Francisco has to do with like the fucking class inequality and how much worse it's gotten since the tech boom in the 2010s. That's the real major cause of it. I don't want cops like rounding up fucking homeless people, which that's the job that like they enjoy doing.
It is mostly what they do is idle in their cars, draw straws as to who, like, you know, took enough roids so they can beat up a Black person today, and then do sweeps. That's what cops do, and be racist on their group chat. You know, and yes, that's the wonderful, incredibly effective model of policing that America exports around the world. So, what's your transition?
Yeah, let's switch gears because this little shift from the police to another element of the criminal legal system, which is the fucking court system.
We're staying in the superstructure, folks. The superstructure is having a normal one these days.
Oh, yeah. Supreme Court, there are two major fucking decisions. The first one is that, and these are both 6-3 decisions that were split along ideological lines. So the conservative-led Supreme Court struck down affirmative action, basically said that universities can't use race as part of holistic admissions. Although the caveat is that, you know, if a student applicant mentions how they overcame racial barriers, that's technically still allowed. I think the reason why it's allowed is because if they try to bar that, it would go against the First Amendment. That's I'm not a lawyer, so this is not like expert legal opinion, but this is just like
they have to have some backdoor, I guess.
Yeah, I think it would be hard for them legally to say that students cannot talk about race in their application, because I think that would bring up some real First Amendment issues. So even a conservative-led court, like, especially with the right saying, oh, we care about free speech, I think it'd be hard for them to make a case, not even politically, but even legally. But anyway, so it struck down affirmative action in higher education. And then the other decision is that they struck down President Biden's student loan relief plan, which was based on the HEROES Act, which allowed for a debt relief and during a time of a national emergency, like a pandemic. And so the Supreme Court struck that down, and it also struck down affirmative action. I have some thoughts. Yeah. Actually, Peter, yeah, why don't
you... Well, I was going to say, as two people who got admitted to an elite college solely for affirmative action purposes, we're obviously very upset about this, because now we're going to have to compete with our... You know, now we would have had to compete with our fellow white colleagues, and we just really were not capable of doing that, you know. So,
we were not like, I mean, it's not like we didn't work hard to get like above 4.0 GPAs in high school, and really
good. Mine was exactly 4, I think, but that's because I took AP classes. But yes.
Yeah, mine was like, I think, 4.2 or something like that. I forgot, 4.1. I forgot. I mean, that's, but like, I mean, Peter's joking, but like, I mean, bringing up something serious, that a lot of the discourse on affirmative action is that people cannot fathom, a lot of opponents of affirmative action, the way it's often framed, is that they can't fathom that there are black people who work hard and that like affirmative action is not like this crutch they're relying on. It's like Harvard and Stanford, like, they're not admitting like loads of fucking black kids from low income environments just because, like, oh, we feel sorry for them for slavery, so we have to admit underqualified black students. Because just if you look at this percentages of the student demographics at universities like Harvard, Stanford, Yale, the percentage of black students is like less than 10%. So,
And of those black students, a lot of them are like from wealthy families. Like,
yes,
there's fewer and fewer, you know, quote unquote, inner city scholarship kids. Like, so yeah, if anything, right, the black upper middle class, like, is a little bit more upset about this, because if you're actually from a poor family, like, you're kind of screwed either way.
Yeah,
but it is, yeah. I mean, the thing that, well, I have two thoughts. The first is that I've always found it to, well, we both have a lot of thoughts. So I'll start with two of them. One is, it is impossible for me to have a lower opinion of someone than I have of, you know, a white person, or, you know, probably even an Asian person who complains about affirmative action. You people are waste of existence. And the fact that some of you were such fucking losers and failures that you formed your stupid little club and you took it to the Supreme Court for what? For what? To waste everyone's time. like, because the system that was rigged in your favor, you had to whine about the fact that it wasn't rigged enough in your favor. So you fucking attention-seeking little... You know, honestly, it's an insult to babies to keep calling these people babies. I can't call them babies. I can't call them worms. We need new insults. But waste of existence, I think, cuts pretty deep. Because that's exactly what they are. And, you know, without calling for anything too crazy, because I think they're... I don't even want to do anything bad to them. I just want them to know that they're waste of existence and failures. And that they really... they have no business really like being alive in their current state. Maybe they like did some severe ego death that could come out of it. But like, no, fuck off. Like, because, you know, like, yeah, affirmative action is already been a joke. Like, they don't want black people in their colleges. They just have to have a few of them. Because like the second thing is that it's actually in their interest to like do affirmative action because it keeps the system more stable. I remember there was this like a clip from some blaxploitation movie that like floated around on Facebook a few years ago. I always remember, and it's one of those scenes where it's like the white men are like sitting discussing racism or whatever, and one of them says like, yeah, it's like, why would I move them up? And the other one says, you have to move them up. Because if you leave a smart one behind, then they turn into a threat. And so, yeah, that's the point. It's like, there's always fucking intelligent people capable of doing anything white people can do. I don't know. Like, it was like fucking hundreds of years where there's like, yeah, man, black people just can't do this. Like, really, I mean, now they still fucking say it. But now they're a little more ashamed about saying it in public. But like, you know, through the 90s, through the mid 2000s, you know. It was like, yeah, there's just some things black people can't do. And it's like, that's obviously not true. But, you know, it's like it's in your interest to take the smart, motivated ones and bring them into the system. And that's what affirmative action does. And that's why it's good for capitalism. Like, you guys are shooting yourselves in the foot when you do shit like this. Like, this is free advice from someone who hates you. You're shooting yourselves in the foot when you act this way because, you know, black people built our own institutions, we built our own universities and schools, and they were pretty fucking good, honestly. Like, pre-integration, yeah. Black schools were more rigorous than a lot of white schools. And, you know, go back to doing that if that's how white people want to behave, but, like, that's what's gonna happen. Like, it's not, like, it's in your interest, and the fact that these fucking people are so myopic that they can't see that is, like, proof that their system should not exist. So yeah, those are my first two thoughts.
I have a number of thoughts. First one, you know, since you mentioned the type of black people who are at those universities, I mean, I'll get a little personal. In my case, I was raised by a single mother, rest in peace, public school teacher, grew up in a predominantly non-white working class environment, and my school was low performing, and I got into Stanford. And I was talking to a friend of mine, very close friend of mine, was another black student at Stanford, and we were talking about this, and he told me, he said, like, you know, you're actually more representative of black America than most of the kids at Stanford. And he was explaining it. He said most of the kids, most of the black students at Stanford fit these categories. One, which is the one you mentioned, Peter, they're usually kids who grew up in upper middle class environments, and they went to really good public schools or very selective, really good private schools. Really good private schools are like really select, like, you know, maybe good public schools, but
magnet schools.
Yeah, magnet schools. There you go. Yeah. Thanks. So yeah, really good magnet schools and very selective like private schools, or maybe even boarding schools. So they went to those schools. Their parents themselves were upper middle class. And I do want to say that I would say, like, the black upper middle class, it's not the same as, like, the white upper middle class, like, especially when you factor in income and wealth. And
it's the upper middle class of not a first world country.
Exactly, yeah. And so Even if they are lucky enough to, let's say, live in a predominantly white community, just the fact of them being black, their property value is going to be lower than their white neighbors. Just because it's a black family in, like, a nice house. Like, yeah, maybe in a nice neighborhood, but, like, you know, so I want to, I think that's important to mention that the black middle class and black upper middle class is not equivalent to white upper middle class. But let's just say, like, they come from black families that I would say are a little more comfortable than most black Americans, particularly, like, lower income and working class black Americans. So they come from those, types of families, and those types of upbringings, and those types of schools. And then he also mentioned that, well, both your parents are African American, like both sides of your family are descendants of enslaved Africans. And another group of black students at these universities are, and this is not like to start a diaspora war, but it's just a fact that a lot of them are children of black immigrants from either the Caribbean or Africa. And those are usually black immigrants from upper middle class backgrounds. So it's not like these are black immigrants from like poor, lower income families. They themselves tend to come from like, you know, comfortable upper middle class life. And then he also said, because he's mixed race, he said like, you know, you're not biracial. So like there's some like mixed race black people. And so I mentioned that because, yeah, like the black population, particularly, especially when you get to top 10 universities. So Harvard, Yale, Princeton, Columbia, Stanford, which is Peter and I's alma mater.
Unfortunately.
I mean, hey, I see it as like, well, I don't know. Actually, going to Stanford actually made me more angry at class inequality.
Oh yeah, so. Yeah. Once you see the people who are like, oh, that's who's going to go on to run the world, you really lose all confidence in the system.
Yeah, I take pride in the fact that I went there and came out a socialist. So, yeah. But I mentioned that because. Affirmative action. Well, here's the thing: affirmative action has been so fucking watered down. In fact, it's actually banned in California because of Prop 209 that passed in the 90s. So, the University of California system here, like UC Berkeley, UCLA, UC Davis, UC Irvine, in the UC system in California, it's actually outlawed, and a lot of people have said that that led to a huge decrease in the numbers of black and Latino students at those universities, which I actually think is true. So affirmative action in and of itself has been pretty gutted. The affirmative action policy at Stanford has been like other universities. Oh, we consider race as part of like holistic admissions. But I would even call into question the efficacy of whatever affirmative action policy is on the books at these institutions because, well, one, I mean, the black populations at these schools are themselves pretty small. And the types of black people they admit are ones who themselves are already pretty economically comfortable, right? So they already have that slight bit of a leg up. It's not to say that they have the same kind of economic privileges as white upper middle class people. But I question like the efficacy of affirmative action, because if you look at the results in terms of the representation of black students at these universities, it's pretty fucking small. And especially once you factor in black people who are descendants of enslaved Africans, it's even worse. And on that point, I'll mention the actual history of affirmative action. I'm not going to give a long history, but I do think that when it comes to affirmative action, the term was first used by, John F. Kennedy in an executive order, which was that it said that employers have to take affirmative action to prohibit racial discrimination in their workplaces. I'm roughly paraphrasing that. And then President Johnson did the same thing with another executive order, because this is coming on the civil rights movement. So these are executive orders, and there wasn't really, it's not like they laid anything specific of how that employers and universities and schools should do it. But basically it was like, you have to take affirmative action to eliminate racial discrimination, because I think people forget how racist schools and jobs were, and also sexist as well. And here's the thing, because women were included as a minority group at that time, white women have been the biggest beneficiaries of affirmative action. And that needs to be, like, screamed from the top of the fucking hills. Because the opponents of affirmative action are like, well, you know, it's unfair and blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, here's the thing. Like, they weren't complaining when white women benefited from it. Because especially, you know, in places like, let's say, the media, it was all white men. And now, like, you go on any, like news, local news programs, or like the press, like, you see a lot of white women. And now it's at the point, like, you know, especially when people complain about dating and stuff like that, like, one thing that actually has changed in terms of the reality of dating is that there are more female breadwinners in relationships, in marriages, or you know, long-term relationships. And a lot of that has to be attributed to the fact that white women benefited from affirmative action, so that they are in a position to be breadwinners in relationships, in marriages. So they benefited the fucking most, but the people that affirmative action was meant to benefit, Black Americans, specifically African Americans, it hasn't really benefited us. And the real roots of affirmative action, and this really has to be made clear, before JFK, the real roots of affirmative action stem from Reconstruction, because it was General Sherman who came up with the policy of 40 acres and a mule. But he was coming off of the demands of people who were formerly enslaved, that, hey, look, because he basically went, you know, to leaders of Black leaders at the time, said, and asked them, like, okay, what do you guys want? You know, because he understood that, hey, there's a civil war, and something has to be made right to people who were formerly enslaved. And especially people who were formerly enslaved who for generations couldn't read or write. So if the U.S. wasn't going to send all of them back to Africa or Liberia, you had to do something. Like, okay, these are people who were formerly enslaved in this country for hundreds of years. We have to do something. Like, we have to, like, integrate them into American society. You have to give them jobs, school. And a lot of Black leaders at the time were saying, well, we need land, because we've been working this land for hundreds of years as slaves. It'd be nice for us to get a piece of that to develop. And so that's where the whole 40 acres and the mule framework came from. And
the 14th Amendment.
Yeah. Yeah. And so then there was a Reconstruction, which basically was to emphasize especially like wage labor for Black people. It didn't really emphasize land ownership that much, but the idea was to redress the harm of slavery and the legacy of slavery, and to integrate formerly enslaved Africans into American society, so that they could have better jobs, better schools, you know, educate themselves, and hopefully, like, be able to own land and participate in, you know, the idea of an American democratic society. And even during that time, there were formerly enslaved people who had already established their own communities, and Black people were practicing self-determination even during slavery and even after slavery. So I say that because a lot of the discourse on affirmative action, especially you hear it a lot in the aftermath of this Supreme Court case, which is that, well, the goal is for diversity and equity, inclusion, and we need diversity, and we need blah, 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 blah. And it's like, okay, those are fine and good, but the reason why it's a fucking issue in the first place is because of slavery. And I think too many people beat around the bush because, you know, liberals don't want to bring up slavery. You know, it's easier to be like, hey, we care about diversity. Okay, yes. But here's the thing. There's a group of people in this country whose ancestors were enslaved for hundreds of years. And the United States owes something to that group of people. And if you're not going to give reparations, affirmative action is like a fucking half measure. And even that's too extreme. So it's like, okay, what the fuck? We can't have affirmative action. You're not going to give us reparations. So it's like, you're right, Peter. It's basically, people just don't want to give black people jobs.
Yeah.
They're content with seeing black people at the bottom.
They really like it. There are a lot of employers and administrators. They, I don't know, like, you know, you just think of, you think about, like, just the image of the happy black slave or, you know, shoe shiner, and it just fills them with joy to see, like, when black people are so happily accept their subservient position in life. I mean, they just love it, you know, and it just makes them so angry that, like, black people aren't grateful for all that white people have done for them. Right. Now, honestly, like, I think probably another thought I have is that I'm, like, probably pro-quota at this point because it really doesn't fucking matter who staffs any of these fucking institutions. Like, I don't think that, like, it really actually doesn't because, you know, centuries upon centuries of incompetent white men rolled in and out there and they all thought they were fucking killing it. So that's why I don't buy the idea that, like, oh, well, you know, quotas make the institution, whatever. I mean, I don't give a fuck about these institutions anyway, but, like, I don't think that it makes them function worse by doing quotas. And no, there was art, right? So, yeah, this new decision was, like, an update on the Bakke decision, which was Bakke versus University of California. Mm-hmm. University of California versus Bakke. That was in 1978, and that said, because they had strict quotas that was, like, you know, 20 white people have to be this percentage, and, you know, there has to be this percentage of black people, and white people got really fucking mad about that. They got rid of, like, the original system, which was quotas, and then they had this, you know, holistic, quote-unquote, affirmative action thing, and now that's too much. But it also is because of just, like, this shitty fucking civil rights legal consensus, which, instead of acknowledging what the actual problem was, which is that, like, these are aggrieved, oppressed minorities who, you know, have specific rights the way there's an international legal framework for. They were like, mm-hmm. No, we're just going to make this about skin color. And, you know, you're not allowed to discriminate based on skin color. And cue all of us having to sit through 60 fucking years of white people intentionally refusing to think about the fucking issue. And aren't you the real racist? And, like, oh my fucking God. We had to sit through that and, like, fucking just, you know, grin and bear it. Now we're back to that. So, you know, what a great fucking country we live in.
And I think it's worth briefly mentioning because the plaintiff who brought forth this suit and why it got to the Supreme Court was actually Asian American. And I've seen, like, a lot of pushback from Asian leftists on this, which I think is a good thing because, you know, what I found really fucked up and is that black people were used as a scapegoat. Like, his whole complaint was that Asian Americans are being discriminated against by affirmative action because it gives, like, undue, like, benefits to black and Latino students, even though Asian students at institutions of higher education, even though Asians are a minority statistically, they still outnumber black people. They outnumber black people at Harvard. They outnumber black people at Stanford. Like, they really fucking outnumber black people at Stanford. Even, like, when I was there, I mean, there is a sizable number of black people, but there were way more Asians.
I mean, it was under 10%. It definitely was under 10%.
Yeah. So, and usually, like, you know, we're talking about Asians at higher education, it's usually not like Cambodians, Laotians, Filipinos. It's usually Chinese, Japanese, Koreans who
are like Vietnamese emigres.
Yeah, and many of them coming from similarly upper middle class backgrounds and usually went to very similar, very good schools, and themselves often living in predominantly white areas. And so I found it so fucking I thought it was just such a slap in the face to black people that we got painted as a scapegoat for Asians not being like accepted enough at these institutions, even though they outnumber black. Like, that's what I found. Like,
colonized fucking mentality. Holy shit, guys.
Yeah, and even though, like, wait a minute, shouldn't your enemy be white kids who get in on like fucking legacy admissions, or whose parents are rich enough to donate money to those schools and have a fucking building named after them? Like, white kids, basically mediocre white kids who get in just because of they have connections to those universities, which that's the majority really of the kids who get let into universities like Harvard, Stanford, whatever they want to say about, you know, we have affirmative action policies. The vast majority of the students who go there that they let in are rich white kids and children of white kids of rich white parents. Like, that's the vast majority. So for black, like, I thought it's really fucking absurd that black people got painted as a fucking scapegoat, which is just an excuse, like, I guess maybe for this Asian guy, like, to ally with white people to screw over black people.
Yeah, like I said, colonized fucking mentality. Fucking,
yeah.
Just keep worshiping, you know. Yeah, they'll let you in the club one of these days, you fucking idiots.
But it screws over Asians too, because like this policy's gonna hurt them. Like, that's the
no,
thing.
I don't know why. See, this is like, I don't know. If your point is like, I'm so fucking smart, but I can't get into this college because the stupid administrators want to let in black people instead, and then you're like, your response to that is to do this bullshit. I think that proves that you weren't smart enough to get into the college in the first place. Not that anyone's quote unquote smart enough to get into the Ivy League, because the reason they're called elite colleges because they're colleges for the elite. It's not because they're better colleges than everyone else.
Yeah.
They just have the most money.
Yeah. And also, you know, we're talking about like rich kids, you know, there's been cheating scandals that have been revealed. So that's how, like, that's also how they get in. So it's not because, like, oh, they're so smart. They know how to fucking cheat.
So, yeah.
Like, that also has to be mentioned. Like, they don't get in based on solely merit. They know how to fucking cheat and get away with it.
Yeah.
So,
no, meritocracy is a myth. I will give Gen Z credit for this, because I think they are a little more hip to the to the realization that meritocracy is a total sham. Because Americans really fucking believed that shit for a long time. That's like why it made them so mad. But no, it's a total fucking joke. It really actually doesn't even make sense logically, that like the people at the top are always the best, because once they're at the top, they're obviously going to make sure their kids like have more opportunities than they had, and so their kids, you know, are like obviously not going to have to have fought as hard. So if it's on who fought the hardest or whatever, then it's obviously breaks down like almost immediately. And also, like, none of these colleges should exist in the first place. I mean, if we're gonna be honest.
My view on that is, I think higher education should be free, and I think colleges need to be like restructured and all that, because, you know, I worked in higher education for 5 years, and here's the thing: it doesn't matter if it's a public university, private university, they all function like corporations. So I think we should get rid of like the whole neoliberal model of education. And have a mix of research schools, trade schools, and for people who are like just nerds and really love learning for the sake of learning, you know, you have institutions for them, but they shouldn't be reserved for fucking children of rich parents. Like, I think they should be open to people of all class, income, and racial backgrounds. But yeah, I don't believe in, like, the university ranking system. Even that's a joke as well. Like,
yeah, I mean, most major universities are real estate development corporations that hand out degrees. And some of them are also incubators, and then some of them are also incubators and think tanks. But that's basically what they do. I mean, the concept of public universities as like being the place to have an educated populace so that we can have a functioning democracy is sad. Why would we want that? Because you educate the people and then they don't want to take the shitty jobs you give them. And so like we're that rapidly moving to a place where, like, I mean, first of all, like, I think most kids under 25, like, and I know this is not, this was not the case when we were, like, 18, 19 in college. When I talk to them, like, they all, like, major in business or marketing, and they think, like, that's a good investment because they all have to go into debt. And, I mean, it's sad because it's like, you don't fucking learn anything in those majors.
No.
And I'm of the opinion, though, because Stanford has so much money, I didn't have to take on any loans. That, like, you should just study what you want if you're paying for it. But,
yeah.
I mean, yeah, like, they're, like, any actual, you know, liberal arts curriculum is getting shredded. I mean, it is very fascinating that, like, this is going along alongside stupid fucking right-wing idiots whining about the woke mob tyranny at college campuses or whatever, and it's definitely another front of that. I mean, the model of debt-financed education was pioneered by, guess who, Adam?
Ronald Reagan.
That's right, who's responsible for everything bad. And it literally was just, oh, these fucking Berkeley fucking, you know, hippies want to protest all day. They're not going to protest when they're $20,000 in debt. They're going to hit the fucking books. And that's literally why anyone has to take out loans to go to college.
And that actually ties into the other decision. We can, we can.
Oh, wow. Look at what I did there.
Yeah. President Brandon, Joe Biden, he had a plan to forgive student loan debt. I mean, it wasn't forgiving all student loan debt. It was forgiving like a portion of it. And he's using the HEROES Act to justify it, which, you know, again, that allows for basically for loan forgiveness in the context of a national emergency. So the Supreme Court struck that down. I mean, I didn't have too many thoughts because, to be honest, I'm not shocked that they did that. And I also think that Joe Biden, I think he had a chance to push for it without having it go to the Supreme Court, and he didn't do that. And I think that this, to me, just shows like how not even weak. I just think that they just don't, you know, they don't really care. But yeah, Peter's right. Like, the whole reason why there are student loans is because, there are protests at Berkeley and universities against the Vietnam War, and Reagan, who was the governor of California at the time, was like, I think he was a governor when he did it, or when he was president.
Yeah, no, it was in the 60s. It was when he was governor.
He was governor. Yeah. Okay. There you go. Okay. Yeah. So, you know, when he was governor of California, he's like, okay, well, we're gonna saddle these kids with a bunch of debt, and so that'll discipline them, so they can't just go to college, study whatever they want, get some crazy ideas about freedom, justice, and equality, and socialism. Or not even socialism, just like ideas like, hey, we should treat people better and we shouldn't have injustice in the world.
And also our colleges are like doing war research at this very moment. That's being used for the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Also that.
Yeah. Anyway, I just wanted to mention, the 2003 law is Higher Education Relief Opportunities for Students Act, the HEROES Act. And the student can provide relief to recipients of student loans when there is a national emergency, to ensure people are not in a worse position financially. And then, so Chief Justice John Roberts said, this is from an NBC article, said, "The Heroes Act language was not specific enough, writing that the court's president requires that Congress speak clearly before a department secretary can unilaterally alter sections of the American economy." And so Biden's plan, it would have allowed eligible borrowers to cancel up to $20,000 in debt. It would have cost more than $400 billion. And that was, yeah, it was blocked by the 8th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals because they issued a temporary hold in October. And 43 million Americans would have been eligible to participate. Now, I think, you know, that's not full-on student loan forgiveness. It's not like wiping away all student loan debt. To be honest, like, that was, you know, pretty modest, and he was using the Heroes Act and tying it to the pandemic. And, you know, I thought that the Supreme Court's reaction was kind of fucking weak because, I mean, Trump had temporarily paused student loan payments during a pandemic. And, like, was that unconstitutional for him to do? So, if they're going to strike down Biden, like, what would the Supreme Court have to say about, like, especially this conservative Supreme Court? Like, would they have issue with Trump doing it during the pandemic? Because student loan payments were paused during that time, you know? So, it's pretty much been kind of paused since the pandemic. And now that we're in this age of, we're kind of, I mean, I guess we're still in a pandemic, but we're kind of, it's like post-lockdown and the economy is still shit. You know, it's like people aren't doing better now. So I thought that the justification that they used was pretty weak. I wasn't surprised, to be completely honest. I'm going to be honest. I wasn't surprised at this.
No. You know, the one good thing I'll ever say about Andrew Jackson, he has a quote where the Supreme Court ruled against him and he was like, well, the court made their decision, I'll let them enforce it. And like, right. If Biden actually gave a shit, he would just be like, okay, well, shut up, losers. I'm going to do it anyway. And they don't do that. The reason they don't do that is because they want all of us, and especially the super smart AP gov nerds, with, you know, who grew up wanting to be a Supreme Court justice, to believe that the president doesn't have any actual power that can be used for the benefit of regular people. And so it's like every single time it's just a fucking nonstop excuse making. It's like, oh, well, the courts do this and the courts are going to return it. And, you know, also that they relied on the courts to do, you know, advanced civil rights in, you know, LGBTQ stuff. So they convince themselves that, like, the courts are actually can be progressive. But no, I mean, they're always a political body, and they're a political body of the bourgeois state. So there are times, I mean, like, I don't know, like, guys, this is the court that gave us Dred Scott decision, like, in Plessy versus right. Ferguson. Yeah. I don't understand the people that, like, had this starry-eyed idea of what the Supreme Court is supposed to be, but it's always been a political body. It's always been the unaccountable, unelected part of the bourgeois state that handles stuff that's too politically hot for, you know, shitbag Congress people. That's what it does. It resolves disputes amongst the ruling class when they can't handle it themselves. That's what it does. And the separation of powers thing or whatever, like, it's fucking stupid. It doesn't. The bourgeois state's gonna do what it wants to do. It, you know, there is an argument to that stuff, like, for, like, I don't know. What I'll say is that stuff was all the ruling class figuring out how not to fight each other. Because, you know, when they're figuring this shit out, every colonial governor in America was like, I just want my own state. Why should we have to be part of one country? That's stupid. That means I have less power. And then they realize, well, no, you're going to get picked off by the British. And, you know, basically what happened to Latin America vis-a-vis American capital would have happened to the U.S. vis-a-vis, like, old British and French capital in the 19th century. And, you know, some people were smart enough to see that. So they're like, we have to have this this structure that, that you know, keeps everyone bought in on an equal level. But, like, it doesn't fucking work. It doesn't really. I mean, it broke down in 80 years. So, you know, like, I'm saying that we, like, anybody who is, like, really does care about this stuff and, like, but it's just, like, a legal nerd, like, just, can we start just fucking, you know, just bullshitting, getting on the whiteboard, like, what a new system looks like? Like, it's got to be better than this. It's got to be. This is this doesn't make any fucking sense anymore. They're not even pretending that it makes any sense. Like, you read any of these fucking opinions and they sound like they are written by 12th graders. Like, it's not, like, this is not the high, whatever people, like, feels idea of what the Supreme Court is has lasted so much longer than what it actually does that now, like, now they're like, oh my God. It's like, no, they've always been this shitty.
Yeah.
It's just sometimes the political mood is like, we need someone to take the hit for this because this thing needs to be done. And nobody in Congress everyone in Congress is too cowardly to do it. So we'll let the Supreme Court do it. That's like why they did Brown versus Board of Education and stuff like that. That's why.
Yeah. No, it's true because I think at the time, like, even a lot of black people at the time, like some black, like, intellectuals, felt that, well, it was going to happen anyway, the Brown v. Board of it was going to happen because the tide was shifting. And so I think I feel similarly with the student loan debt because just with the makeup of the Supreme Court, it seemed obvious that they were going to strike it down. And yeah, it's the Supreme Court has always been a political institution. It's never been about the way it's portrayed in government classes that it's above politics, it's above partisanship, and it makes, you know, these nonpartisan decisions when it comes to the law. No, the Supreme Court is influenced and shaped by the politics and mood of the time, you know, and also the biases of the justices who sit on the Supreme Court and the way they interpret the Constitution all comes, like, from their own fucking ideologies, you know. So yeah, Supreme Court has never been a nonpartisan, non-political institution. It always has been. And in this case, I think these decisions are part of a conservative backlash against the mild reforms of the 60s and 70s civil rights movement.
They stayed mad about it for 60 years. You know, you got to give them credit.
And so, yeah, this is a backlash against that. And, yeah, that's why I'm not surprised with them wanting to going against canceling student loan debt because, it benefits the capitalist ruling class to keep people in cycles of student loan debt because, you know, it makes people much more subservient to the whims of capital because, yeah, when you keep people in, like, cycles of student loan debt that you can't go bankrupt on.
That's why I could spend a year protesting, doing Occupy shit after college. I don't have any loans.
Same here. I don't have any loans either. Anyway, I think that's a good note to end this. We're like an hour and a half in.
Well, we knew this was going to go a little long.
Yeah, we've covered a lot of ground. So if you like this episode, go to realsankarihours.org. Become a patron for $5 a month, and we also have, like, different work schedules, so we haven't been shelling out as much content as we used to, so our kind of flow of uploading is a little bit different these days just because changes in life and work schedule and all that. But yeah, we're gonna keep putting out stuff, and if you like this episode, first you should tell a friend or a family member and share it with them and listen to
play it. Please play it to your most annoying liberal friend.
Yes. And your conservative friends too. And your conservative relatives. Yeah. You have them. Have them listen to this. So anyway, yeah. So become a patron, $5 a month at patreon.com/realsankarihours, and also you know, go to our website, realsongcarhours.org. That shows all where you can follow us. And we actually plan on uploading different kinds of content, like writing some individual or co-hosting live streams. So we have other plans for the podcast. Aside from us recording episodes, we plan to put out more content. So we're also doing things a little bit different. So just kind of be patient with us, especially, and yeah, be patient with us if we're taking our time to upload episodes and all that kind of stuff. But anyway, yeah, that's it on our end. Should we do the sign out?
Yeah.
All right. Keep the faith.
Stay dangerous.
All right. Peace out, y'all.
Peace.